William Warrick is our guest, and the name of the documentary is The Phoenix Incident. And in that documentary, you bring up a Special Operations Flight Troubleshooter 615. Tell our audience what we're talking about.
Troubleshooter 615 was a Navy SEAL team that was apparently dropped off, forming a crew was dropped off at Dam Neck Base here in Norfolk sometime in the evening of March 13, 1997. Which was less than 24 hours after I had saw my UFO, my boomerang UFO, also in Norfolk, Virginia, although at a different location, close to the Norfolk Naval Air Station. And apparently, from the reports that I've read, the ones that have been published at least, the Troubleshooter 615 was on its way back to land on a little crew carrier, a tender ship. I don't recall the name of it, but they were going to land on the backside of this small frigate, and for some unknown reason, they basically crashed into the ocean, and all four men died. Now, the importance of this particular event is the time, and the time of this event was at 11:20 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The interesting thing about that, is when you correlate that time to time period, the actual time of the Phoenix Lights, it means that the Troubleshooter 615 crashed basically simultaneously with the height of the Phoenix Lights. And since we're talking about both of these places being some sort of stargate or area where UFOs can come and go at will or travel through certain points, you know, maybe island hopping from one point to another point, that something happened. Perhaps there was an object over the frigate, which the air crew didn't see until the last minute, and executed a course correction. And when they did so, they weren't able to recover from it, crashed into the ocean. And that's how Troubleshooter 615.
Yeah, I get the connection. Speaking of that, did any satellite pictures or radar pictures of this UFO activity in 1997?
There are. None that I have seen from March 13th, 1997, but the satellite that would have been covering that, which was the Mystery.
Yeah, that was
satellite.
Down. What's the deal there?
Yeah. Well, apparently that was actually taken out many hours before any of these events started to transpire on the East Coast with Troubleshooter 615 or with the Phoenix events in Phoenix 2 hours later. I take that back. It actually happened simultaneously because 9:20 p.m. in Phoenix was 11:20 p.m. off 80 miles off the coast of Norfolk. So, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Well, yeah, but basically the radar and satellite pictures, and we're talking about that satellite going down.
Yeah, the Misty 3 satellite apparently was, when I say taken out, I don't mean destroyed. The report is from the manufacturer, Spectrum Astro, was that the batteries were actually drained, that an object, a spaceborne object, had apparently hovered over this particular satellite, which has a bunch of miniature sensors on it, you know, so you get infrared, ultraviolet, and all kinds of other sensors. That broad spectrum sensory package, which covered the North American continent, or parts of the North American continent, had its batteries drained and was completely disabled. So that if an object, say a boomerang-shaped object, which for all intents and purposes, if you saw it at low altitude, would look like a cigar-shaped object unless you saw it from below, then perhaps that boomerangs or multiple boomerangs were on the North American continent. They knocked out that satellite so that we couldn't see them from above, and then they shadowed that frigate so that when the Troubleshooter 615 guys were coming in, the standard operating procedures take off the night vision goggles, and they perhaps did not see that object until the last minute because the ship's radars are pointing out towards the horizon. They don't point straight up. So possibly that's what that boomerang was doing. It might explain what happened at Troubleshooter 615, as well as why the satellites would have been taken out and disabled.
If I'm reading between the lines something that that's not there, tell me. But it seems to me like you think there might have been a battle going on between these two entities of the ETs at this time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, if you really want to throw the third wild card in there, it's us trying to maybe shoot down them. In fact, at the X conference, I had a short conversation with Paul Hellyer, who is one of the most distinguished diplomats
right.
in Canada. And, I mean, he said point blank that the rest of the country within the inner circles of the defense establishments are very concerned that our cowboy president there is going to start a conflict that he can't control. And they're very concerned about this. And although he wasn't in power, of course, in 1997, I mean, obviously the implication is that we need to be very careful about who we go and try and shoot down.
Now let's talk about Governor Simington.
Yes.
That's pretty incredible if you stop and think about it. He makes fun of it right after it happens, and then later he says, well, I was just trying to stop a panic.
Yeah.
What do you
know,
think of that?
I was given the information about Governor Simington a couple of weeks before I did my initial interview with you, and I don't know if you recall, you were pressing me on something, and I told you I really couldn't talk about it. I promised James Fox and Leslie Keene that I wouldn't break the story until they did, because they're the ones that did all the work, and they deserve that. But originally that story was supposed to break on the anniversary, which is March 13th, 2007, the 10-year anniversary. And they had some trouble getting some media outlets to cover it. And unfortunately, I mean, it did get on CNN, but it was a 2.5-minute blurb or Anderson Cooper. And that was it. I mean, and there were some other things, but that was basically it. A lot of us, myself included, I confirmed that the story was true. And I didn't want to talk about it. Like I said, it was their story to break.
Mm-hmm.
But, I was like, when I initially heard it, I thought, this can't be true. I mean, you're talking about the man who spoofed and scoffed and made a fool of anyone that made a report about what they saw. I'm not talking about lights in the sky. I'm talking about solid boomerang and triangular-shaped objects. And here he is coming out 10 years later and saying, yeah, I did see something. And not only that, but, I mean, in the Anderson Cooper interview, he basically defied the United States military to prove that it wasn't a military craft. And here, and he's a decorated Air Force pilot from the Vietnam War, combat pilot. You know, so he's a qualified observer. He's a government official, and he's probably the most important person who could have made a difference in that case had he, you know, come forward and said, yes, I did see. I mean, if he had said what he said in 2007, if he had said that in 1997, God, I mean, I don't know where this case would be, but because he did that whole spoof and called the quote-unquote emergency press conference, which was supposed to be for state emergencies, and all the press showed up and he made a spoof of it, I mean, that the story essentially pretty much died right there as far as the mainstream media is concerned.
Reconstructing all of this, what do you make of it?
This is the Simington thing. Here's the thing about Simington, okay? And I don't think a lot of people know this, but that he, or realize this, but he was under indictment at the time.
Yes.
By the federal government.
I remember.
In fact, you know, from talking to Mike Fortson and Francis Barward, apparently he was actually in court.
Well, I think he was coming down the steps of the courthouse, and somebody asked him something.
Yeah, exactly. And then you know, he goes into the courtroom, and I guess it's a 3 or 4 hour, you know, closed chamber meeting with the judge. And then he comes out and announces that he's going to, you know, this emergency press conference. And Francis Barward points this out in our documentary, and it's really, really, you know, it makes sense. How did he have time to put together the conference, to get the alien makeup and costume and all the rest of that stuff while he was in judge's chambers and was excommunication from everybody? And yet he had time to come out and do all that within just an hour or two.
So you think he was following a script somebody wrote for him?
When he got in that judge's chambers, I'm sure that he was told exactly what to say and exactly what to do, and he did it. Or else.
Yeah, he was under indictment at the time.
And after he beat that, the guy's beat 3 indictments, and from what I understand, it's a lot of bull. It never should have happened in the first place. But that's politics, and there's nothing worse than national politics except for state politics or local politics.
He had a famous uncle in the Truman administration, I think.
There you go. In fact, you're one of your producers was the one that brought that to my attention.
The Simonton connection is actually very intriguing because
as your producer had sent me an email back in 2007, apparently the uncle or cousin or relation of Fife Symington III was Stuart Symington.
Yeah, he was actually the first Secretary of the Air Force.
And he had had an interaction with Secretary Forrestal, who later committed suicide. And apparently Stuart Symington had met with Secretary Forrestal in Holby Sound, which is the same area where President Clinton allegedly injured his knee in 1997 during the Phoenix Lights. And like Forrestal before him, Clinton was taken to the Bethesda Naval Hospital. And the only difference is that Clinton had surgery on his knee, and Secretary Forrestal allegedly committed suicide. So it's an interesting sort of, almost like an echo of the events that happened in 1997, except that, of course, apparently no one was killed during that incident. But it's interesting to note that the injuries that were sustained by Clinton were right around the time that the Phoenix Lights were occurring, basically simultaneously, and I have to wonder if Clinton and Symington didn't talk that night. Is that apparently in the early 1960s, Governor Symington, who wasn't governor then, of course, but in the 1960s, Fife Symington actually saved Bill Clinton's life when Bill Clinton and Symington were in New England at a beach party, and Clinton got in some trouble and apparently saved Clinton from drowning. Yeah. And then, of course, if you look at what happened with Symington being indicted by the government and none of the indictments would stick, and the possibility that, you know, he was basically told by the government, you know, what to do. In fact, if you look at the spoof that he did with CNN, if you look at it very carefully, he's not speaking from the heart. He's reading a written statement, and his head is down, and he doesn't pick his head up till he's done reading each particular sentence in the statement. So that, again, it's just another sort of circumstantial evidence that points out to me that he was probably, even though he may say it was of his own volition, I don't really believe that. I think that he was basically told, you know, you're not going to talk about this, and if you talk about it, we're going to throw you in jail. You know, we're going to convict you on the charges that we trumped up against you in the first place, basically. And there's one more thing that I don't think we got to mention. As if all of that wasn't enough to connect Clinton with Symington, one of the very last things that Bill Clinton did when he was leaving office was to give Fife Symington a presidential pardon for all past and apparently current indictments which were going to be forged against him again. And so perhaps this was sort of payback to Symington for not disclosing the UFO information and vice versa.
Well, that pardon by Clinton would certainly allow Symington to come clean on the UFO issue.
Absolutely, absolutely. I didn't even think of that. That's pretty good, Jerk. I didn't even think of that.
Okay.
I love when I do these interviews because, you know, there's always some kind of angle that I didn't think of before, and I go, oh, my God,
hey,
look at that.
You told me before that you thought the Secret Service was rushing Clinton around to protect him because they thought we were under attack, and maybe we were.
The story just gets even more bizarre. Now, I'll kind of try to tie all this in together and expound on a little bit more. But you have at 11:20 p.m., you have the crash of Troubleshooter 615 off the east coast of Norfolk. At 11:30 p.m., President Clinton allegedly injures his knee in Hobie Sound while he's visiting the golfer Greg Norman. So this is 10 minutes after Troubleshooter 615. These two events are simultaneous to what is happening in Phoenix, which is the UFO explosion that's going on. And so when you take the 11:30 p.m. time period and you correlate that to Phoenix time, they are simultaneous events, even though they are 2 hours
apart. Well, they may have been. Yeah, and from your information, what you say?
Yeah. Well, you had the disabling of the Misty 3 satellite, which NORAD probably would have been troubled by. Then you have the numerous reports of going on in Phoenix, okay, a couple hours after that. Then simultaneous with those reports in Phoenix, you have Troubleshooter 615, which crashes into the middle of the Atlantic, which probably sent alarm bells up. And then simultaneous with that, of all those events, you have, the alleged injury of President Clinton injuring his knee. Yeah, I think that the alarm bells went off after Troubleshooter 615 went down, and that they thought they were under attack and went to DEFCON 2. This didn't just happen on March 13th. This happened also later on in April when Craig Button's A-10, Craig Button's, the loss of the A-10.
The pilot that went berserk, supposedly.
Supposedly, allegedly, yeah. There's no evidence for that. But, one of the things that we found out was that he may not have been in control of his aircraft. That there are reports, there are some government officials who were contacted basically were told by the pilots that they were not in control of their aircraft. Now, I don't know what that means. I don't know if that means that, a UFO came in and, somehow took control of their aircraft, or if it means that there is something more nefarious going on where I think this is leading, is that there is a group that obviously is responsible for putting up the disinformation about these things, and for whatever reason, whether Craig Button knew about the flare drops or saw a UFO or intercepted a UFO or however he was involved in this, meaning the Phoenix Lightning.
That happened some time back, but Lynn Swoboda, she's involved in this story somehow.
It just gets more and more sinister. Both of these pilots, Amy Lynn Swoboda was, from what I understand, all the information that I could get, was Craig Button's trainer. Craig Button was in the Davis-Monthan base to train with his A-10 for, I think, about 6, 7, 8 weeks or something like that. And his trainer was Amy Lynn Swoboda. So you got the March 13th Phoenix lights, which the government says were dropped by a visiting A-10 air squadron, happening on March 13th, 1997. Then 2 weeks later, on April 2nd, 1997, in the middle of the daytime, you have an A-10 pilot from the same base that the government says dropped the flares. Okay, it's from the same planes that dropped the flares. Okay, Craig Button on April 2nd takes off and disappears, and allegedly flies his $1 million aircraft into the side of a mountain in the middle of the daytime,
right?
800 miles from his base. Then you have on May 27th, 1997, again just 6 weeks after that, maybe 8 or 9 weeks after the Phoenix lights, you have his trainer dies in a quote-unquote accident. And in fact, if you go back and look at the record, there are five or six A-10 crashes.
No, I you're right. I don't think we lost A-10s that many in Desert Storm.
We may have lost one. I believe there was one pilot that got shot down, but I'm not positive about that. But again, that was a combat operation. And none of these other things were. And I document there were 20 or 30 plane crashes like this, that if you really look into the details of it, you go, what is going on? There was one particular plane crash between a German and an American C-130. It was a spy plane, basically, and another German plane, which was also a spy plane, in the middle of the daytime, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, off the coast of Africa. Now, how have two of the most sophisticated wartime airplanes with the most sophisticated equipment known to man crash in the middle of the daytime over the middle of the Atlantic Ocean?
Are you saying they're victims because of a UFO cover-up, or did the UFOs and the ETs do it, or do we know?
The ETs, we had orders to stand down. In July of 1997, for the first time in history, in Norfolk Naval Air Station, all five U.S. aircraft carriers were in port. That's the first time it's happened. I don't think it's happened since, but that's the first time it happened since Pearl Harbor. And I get the distinct impression, and also two times, and once in 1996 and late 1996, again in September of 1997, after that incident that I just told you about with the German and the American C-130s crashing, the U.S. military and the U.S. Air Force had a stand down of all non-combat air operations. And that's the first time, those two times are the first two times that's ever happened, period, in the history of the Air Force. So yeah, there's no question I think that they had. We were basically told, you got to cool it off or we're going to start taking planes out of the sky. I think that's what it boils down to. Even if they didn't have any communication, that's what happened.
Well, we're still here.
Yeah, well, and again, there are some crashes that have happened recently that may be related. But again, it's so difficult to tell unless you have a rash of them. I mean, back then in 1997, we had 3 or 4 crashes in one day. You know what I mean? So when you have that much evidence to sort of support the idea that, that something is going on, that our skies are occupied, and that that military people are being, you know, killed either accidentally or inadvertently.
I mean, the war hog, the ATM, is basically a plane that attacks tanks and things. Why this particular type of aircraft?
Well,
the UFOs were involved, or maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was just a cover-up, and these people were going to talk, but why would they know?
I have two theories behind this.
Okay.
This ties back to the Phoenix Lights, which is kind of cool. The visiting Air 10 National Air Guard squadron that was supposedly the ones that would drop the flares, and I have no doubt that they did drop flares. The name of that particular operation was called Project Snowbird. Now, the really interesting thing about that is if you look back into the history and the declassified information about UFOs, excuse me one second, what you find is that Project Snowbird was a code word back in the 60s and the 50s for a operation which was conducted to make people believe that secret aircraft were in fact UFOs.
Really? I didn't know about that.
Absolutely. And so, you know, what's the difference between 1950 and 1997? I don't think there's any difference. I think that there was a visiting Air 10 squadron from Maryland, like they said, who was sent up to the sky to conduct the air operations and told to drop flares, and as part of their quote-unquote training. And they probably had no idea what was going on. And this was all part of a sophisticated cover story. I think that Craig Button's A-10 probably was in the sky that night as well, perhaps participating in some other exercises just as the other A-10s were. And that if the reports that they were not in control of their aircraft, meaning that someone else was controlling their aircraft remotely, are true, then perhaps, and again, this is just speculation, I don't have any concrete evidence, but I'm just trying to put the pieces together, perhaps Craig Button's A-10 was remotely controlled in such a way that it dropped those flares in an ascending sort of boomerang-shaped pattern, which is what gave us the 9:20 p.m. flare story and the now infamous video. And the reason I say all that is because from what I understand, and I could be wrong, but from what I understand, even the old military's report about the visiting A-10 National Guard and the flares says that those planes were back on the tarmac by about 8:30 p.m. Now, that raises a very important conflicting problem, and that's that the 9:20 p.m. video of the flares obviously could not have been dropped by them. But if that particular squadron and those men were sent up to do a training exercise and were told to fly a certain pattern with the lights on and with lights off and dropping flares and not dropping flares, then this could be part of what they called Project Snowbird, because that's what they said that's what it was. You know,
mm-hmm.
Whatever, you know, that was the name of the exercise.
Do you think most of these A-10 crashes that happened around this time were involved with the same planes, same equipment that were involved in the Snowbird thing?
You know,
there's only way to prove that. I don't know.
Now that you mentioned that, you just got me thinking about an angle that I hadn't really thought of. Well, let's think about this for a second. Let's just assume that it wasn't just that Craig Button's A-10 that was tampered with. Let's suppose that they had other A-10s at other bases who were set up with the same equipment, the same software, which would allow someone to take control of the plane in case a UFO flap occurs somewhere other than
Phoenix.
They
got a good point there, and I think there's a lot of evidence that you can take control of airplanes by remote control.
Look, all of it's fly-by-wire. Every plane made today is fly-by-wire. All you got to do is change the harness pack out and change, you know, the computer pack out. And I'm sure that can be done. There's no question that it can be done because there's not a direct control linkage between the pilot and the control surfaces. So, you know, most of the planes that you fly in today, all the pilot does is pull back on the yoke and take off and then drive for 5 or 6 hours and then, you know, land, and that's it. That's all they do. They monitor systems. That's about it. So, yeah, I mean, there's no question that the technology existed. It's existed for 20 or 30 years at the minimum. They may have had some trouble incorporating into each individual particular avionics system, and that may be the reason why some of these plane crashes occurred. In fact, I do know that there was some sort of new update to the radar, ground tracking radar system that they had, the avionics system they had, but I'm not completely versed on it. as well as I probably should be. But
I understand what you're saying. We only have about 5 minutes left. Edgar Cayce comes into this. tell me about that. We talked a little bit about this before.
Yeah, you know, and this is really more fascinating to me than a lot of the other stuff. Basically, Edgar Cayce, how do I explain this real quickly? He moved all around the country trying to find a place that he felt that his psychic abilities would be enhanced. He found a place in Virginia Beach, Virginia. I later found after my UFO encounter that the latitude where I saw my UFO encounter was exactly the same latitude as where Cayce located his facility. And this was important because I had read a book, again, after my UFO encounter by a gentleman named Bruce Caffey, who was a pilot from New Zealand, who wrote a book called The Harmonic Conquest of Space. And in that book, he basically says that, and talks about Edgar Cayce in this particular location that both my UFO event and Cayce located his hospital at in Virginia Beach, that at this particular latitude, you could conduct, this was a sort of harmonic sort of stargate point, where, you know, UFOs and other things are seen. And so it really just blew me away that here's this guy who writes this book in 1969, Bruce Caffey, talking about this harmonic stargate point, which is at exactly the same latitude where I saw my UFO in Norfolk. And he correlates that with Edgar Cayce, who located his hospital exactly the same latitude point. Now, it appears that Cayce's psychic abilities allowed him to sense these other hyperdimensional fields, let's call them, where these stargates might be more easily created, let's put it that way. And so, it appears that in 1925, Cayce was the one that found the location where these sort of tests could be conducted. Well, later on, it seems that, and this is where the Philadelphia experiment comes in, apparently, the Philadelphia experiment, Project Rainbow, occurred at exactly that same latitude, not too far from where I saw my UFO. And when I went back and looked at records from the 1950s, a couple of important ones, the Nash Fortenberry sighting, and there was a couple of other ones in 1952, July 16th, where the UFO paths that the UFOs took all seemed to originate or end right around this same area where I saw my UFO, which is where the Philadelphia experiment allegedly took place. So the Edgar Cayce connection to all this is that this psychic who lived, 75 years ago was able to sense, apparently, the area that was best to conduct these experiments at, time and space experiments, et cetera, et cetera, manipulating the gravitational forces around the Earth. And so all of these incredible things that we learned about can possibly or might be possibly traced back to Edgar Cayce, which is
it
amazing.
Is. We only have a couple of minutes left. We want to mention the documentary and the premiere again in New York, and we will before we get off. And also, you can pick up that DVD for $20 and the postage from a couple of websites. Go ahead and give those for the people listening on iPods.
Absolutely. It's www.SiriusSeminars.com, and Sirius is spelled like the star Sirius, which is SIRIUS, seminars.com. You can also link to UFOEyewitness.com, and that will also give you a link where you can purchase the DVD as well.
You're the one who brought this up at the first about the battle maybe going on, and we're either involved by trying to shoot down one group or another, or we're just the catch. What happened to that group with the Hale-Bopp comet? Are they still traveling through space, or did they drop off here, or what happened?
I don't know. I think.
I mean, we're still here 11 years later.
Yeah, we're still here. The Native Americans, just about everyone that I've spoken to, says that 2012 we will have our answer. This, of course, relates to the Mayan, end count of 13. It's also interesting that when you take the Mayan end date of, it's actually, if you write it down, it's 13.0.0.0.0. And all of these UFO events tend to occur on the 13th. In fact, besides the Phoenix Lights incidents, which occurred on the March 13th, Dim Teletesso did a spectral analysis of the lights from that night, some of the lights, not all of them, I don't think, not the ones, the flare drops, but at any rate, he found that some of the lights matched the Fatima lights in 1917 in Portugal.
And we've done shows about the Lady of Fatima, and maybe there was UFO intervention there.
Yeah, that was a great show. So, you know, maybe this is that particular extraterrestrial group, or at least one of these groups is that particular extraterrestrial group. And the other one...
You think anything's going to be happening this year?
Well, you know, look, you had Stevensville in January. You had a huge flap going on in England all summer long. I mean, just unbelievable stories coming out of England right now, and videos and everything. And if you just go on YouTube, they've got, you know, F-16s from Israel and all kinds of different defense countries who are chasing these orbs. And I mean, America needs to wake up, okay? You know, something's going on, and we need to pay attention to it. And if we don't, I think we're going to be in big trouble.
That's the way we're going to have to leave the show.
Yeah.
William Warwick, good luck with your documentary, and we'll be talking to you again soon.
It's been great, Jerry. Really appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.